We welcome in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His new book on Scrooge, the movie, the 1951 classic, is coming out soon, and lots of other things in the works. Good day, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, Sir Richard of Bangor. We wish you the best of this dawning Christmas season.
Yes, I look forward to the pitchy gloom, as your man Washington Irving wrote.
He's charmed by that pitchy gloom, right? Look at you transitioning right away into the holiday season.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk. Let's start with what so many people are talking about, the Peter Jackson Beatles documentary. You wrote a terrific piece for the Daily Beast. I got paywalled out of the Wall Street Journal piece, but I assume that was also great.
Here's hoping. You should have, I could have sent you the file. I should have thought of that. My bad. I think it gives you like a limit of how many things you can look at. Sometimes I'm locked out of my own things and Daily Beast, things like that. Like I couldn't see the Paul McCartney one until recently. So that was the longer one. That was the 3,000-word one. It was about the entire shebang. And the Wall Street Journal one was an op-ed about the 1970 film, Let It Be. So this time a week ago, I had just gotten the advanced screener link from Disney. They didn't give me a lot of time. So it was just sitting there for almost 8 hours and then writing the 3,000-word piece. And I would say that I took it, the docuseries, in ways that other people didn't. I saw a lot of things written about it, of course, and discussed on Twitter and Facebook. I thought a lot of it was off. I thought a lot of it was oversimplification. And I think that comes with people these days just saying whatever they want to say and not really being immersed in the subject for a long time. Because when you are immersed in a subject for a long time, it's as if you can go inside the heads of the people there. And I think it also helps, too, to be someone who's a writer who thinks in terms of character and human nature and that sort of thing.
Well, I think also people project what they want to see, what they believe they saw over the course of those 7+ hours.
Oh, sure. That's a good point. I saw this guy yesterday, for instance, and he was on Facebook. He had all this broken grammar and everything, but we had like 46 friends in common. And I thought, broken grammar, friends in common, he's probably in publishing. And his heyday in publishing was like 1996. It's like with the Phoenix and stuff like that. I went to his Facebook page, and he said, I just saw the first episode of Get Back. It was really depressing. I don't like it. It sucks. A few hours later, he's like, it's a few hours later. I'm watching the second episode. They're so happy together. I love those Beatles. Get Back is brilliant. Something like, you are unstable, sir. And but that was what he wanted. You mentioned projection. That's what he wanted to see. He wanted to see. I have a term for it, Kimball. I think he can catch on. Care Bearism. That's what he wanted. And these were not guys that were happy in each other's company. And I hear theories that people advance, like, oh, yeah, Paul McCartney. He knew his friend John Lennon was really struggling. So he tried to be altruistic and quiet about it without letting anyone know by encouraging the band to start this project so quickly after the White Album. And it wasn't that quickly. It was a few months. I mean, the way I am, I feel like something from 5 minutes ago is ancient history and it's time to prove myself again. But that's not how people tend to work. And the reason McCartney was so gung-ho about starting, I'm sure, was because he was a creative. He wanted to keep going. And he also knew, it's really, I think this is a key point, he's the protagonist of the docuseries. It's his journey more than anyone else's journey, because the others have already accepted something that he's having a hard time getting to that point. And they've reached that point. They haven't officially reached that point, but they know. And I think McCartney was trying to milk everything he could out of this thing that was the only thing he did know. It's like the last week of senior year of high school. I mean, it wasn't for me. I didn't have a happy high school experience. But for a lot of people, I think they're trying to savor that week and milk it and say, well, there's still 5 days left, and sort of bargaining with themselves that way. And so I really think the film, the docuseries, was his journey towards a kind of acceptance. That's, I mean, why do you think he wrote a song called Let It Be?
Right. Well, and I thought your analogy in the Daily Beast piece about the guys who have who've graduated from high school, but you're somehow still there and hanging around with their friends. And what do? You go to the safe places, and we saw that repeatedly throughout the series, that they went back to talking about the old times, remembering concerts, remembering the Cavern, remembering Hamburg, remembering the special they did in 64, and even going back frequently to play the old rock and roll songs that they started playing.
Oh, spot on. And because if you know that Beatles special that you referenced from 1964 called Around the Beatles, it's not a very well-known special. And if you also know how the Beatles talked about themselves in the years going forward, they didn't have remarkable memories, but they had sort of remarkable eidetic recall during this period. They were that focused, like, remember that time sophomore year? And I bring up high school, and I think that's an apt analogy, because that's how long these guys have been together.
Right.
Not just they've been together. They've been together, in a way, against the world. They were locked in on each other because, in large part, they were in a situation that no one really understood. And you can see that even Mal Evans is an outsider among the four during all of this. And it's like,
even George Martin was, I thought, more of an outsider. He just sort of strolled through, would nod once in a while, but was really not an active player.
He wasn't keen on this project and the direction it was going, for one thing. And you can tell him be this forced cheerleader at times, where he's saying, everyone got along really well today. It's going great. It's not going that great. And he's trying to build up momentum. And the person that he does connect with, and I wrote about this, is McCartney. They share a wavelength, because Martin is a natural producer. He's natural with music. And McCartney was natural with music. The other three weren't natural musicians. Lennon certainly wasn't. And he was able to use that to his benefit with how he would write songs. And George Harrison is a guitarist. There's this big push to canonize St. George, but the truth is, Harrison was really a miserable prick. He was someone who would drone on forever, boring people about his interests that they didn't share. He was notorious for this, but it's become the vogue to make him. He was the talented one. He wasn't. That's silly, not compared to the other two. And as a guitarist, when McCartney wanted to, and I think that's what led to this tension during this moment, talking about guitar playing, McCartney could paste him. McCartney plays that solo on Taxman. George Harrison couldn't play that. It's just that everyone fell into their role, and you have to have people in their role. Like, somebody has to lead off. Somebody has to start on the mound. Like, it has to work that way. It's just how it has to go to fill out the roster. And they filled out their roster of four, and they took it as far as they could go. And watching it, it's like I also wrote, Abbey Road becomes something of a minor miracle that they got to it, that they could do it. But as I think we've discussed before, they also didn't have the songs at this point. They didn't have songs at the level that they had previously. They had a lot of fragments, and they were able to, I'll use it as a verb, beetle those fragments into something larger than what they were on their own. But really, the crux of the Beatles, their genius, is in the songs. And now they were out there. It's like the pitcher on the mound who doesn't have his best stuff. He's going to gut it through that, Frank Tanana it through that given baseball game. But eventually it's going to catch up with you. And it caught up with them and their solo careers.
And the personal dynamic is so fascinating. Ringo, look, everybody loves Ringo. Why not? He's just trying to get along. George clearly can't wait to get away from the rest of them all. And there's that moment when he says, you know, I've written so many songs, I've got my Beatles output for the next 10 years. And I just want to make my own album. But you wrote about it, that connection between John and Paul, and we see it time and time again, that magic, even though they were going at each other a little bit and perhaps with some gloves on, but boy, when they clicked, it was like nothing else. And the other guys would just be off at the side watching and taking it all in.
They didn't even need to be getting along or be talking for one to denote the energy between them. Some people just have a connection. We've talked about connection. I think connection is something that most people will never have in their life. Now, they won't say that to themselves because they have to think about being connected to at least somebody in a certain way, but that doesn't make it real. I've only had in like my life, I'd say, one real connection. I've had people that I've counted on and been there for and loved and things like that, but that's different. We're very fortunate to ever experience a true connection. And when you have that connection and the person can leave and you can leave or you can fight and fall out or whatever it is, if you are back in the same place again, you will be connected once more because you always have been. It's something beyond what you say. There are sometimes energy bonds between people. And I think that's what you can actually see in this film. You can see those energy bonds between Lennon and McCartney. And I write about one of them quite specifically when Harrison is stormed off. He's quit the band, like Starr did earlier during the White Album sessions. And McCartney is going through Get Back, and he needs this word to fall in, something left your home in blank, blank, Arizona. He doesn't know what the word should be. He knows that it has to have two syllables. And finally, he lands on Tucson. And we find out, because he has to explain it to him after, Lennon doesn't even know what Tucson, Arizona is. He doesn't know it's a city in the American Southwest. But as soon as McCartney lands on that word, Lennon gives them this look, and they're moving forward. That's all they need. They don't have to have anything else. And there is no one else in the world, I think, that who could have given McCartney that look that would have meant that to him. And I don't mean like meant it like, oh, be still my heart. This is what it means to me emotionally. I mean like that look of the rock. And it's like, yes, this is right. On we go.
Now, I remember seeing Let It Be a couple of times, but it's been probably 40 years since I've seen it. So my memory's a little faded. And I don't think this replaces Let It Be in telling the story of the Beatles. I look at it as another chapter. And people who want to oversimplify and say, well, Let It Be was about the band breaking up. And this is about how much they loved each other. Man, I think that's way too simple because they weren't simple guys. You saw all shades of it in this 8 hours of Peter Jackson culling through the archives. And to me, that's what made it good is that I didn't take it as the definitive story of the Beatles, but certainly a more in-depth one that showed us both sides.
Well, I'll tell you what it was. It was mismarketed because of this age of having to pretend everything is Care Bears. Because I had written about this in the blog a number of times, that I was quite hesitant about this docuseries from everything I'd read about. It was going to show that the Beatles weren't going to break up. Well, I knew that they were, and I knew why they were, and I understood it. And so I was wondering what this was going to look like, how that could possibly be rammed in, this idea of happy, happy Hare Krishna Beatles, because that wasn't the reality. And so even after the docuseries came out, Jackson was saying, oh, it's so happy. It's not. It really isn't. It's not what it claims to be in the official literature from Disney and from Jackson. It's closer to Let It Be that way because it's the reality. It's what happened. And when they go back to these old covers and this music and everything, do you ever have that friend in high school and maybe like you weren't that popular and he wasn't that popular and maybe you didn't get along that great, but you kind of bonded over music and it was the thing you took solace in. It was your comfort zone. It was your safety space. It was the kid coming home from school and sitting on the bed and putting on the headphones and cranking The Real Me off Quadrophenia by The Who, which is largely what Quadrophenia is about. I think that's what the Beatles were too, because these were guys who became friends for a number of different reasons. But one reason that we can't underrate is their record collections. Mm. That's what they sat around and bonded over. That was always their main love. And it was that first main love that bonded them together, maybe more so than like Lennon thinking, oh, this little kid Harrison, which is how he saw him, is like so cool and he's playing raunchy on the bus and everything. I don't think he looked at it that way. I think he looked at it like, oh, he likes Gene Vincent, like I like Gene Vincent. And he had a different kind of connection with McCartney. But it's not this happy thing. There really aren't any, I would say, blissful moments in it, like the ones that Washington Irving, even amidst sadness, is able to find when he writes about Christmas, as we'll get to. It's just real. And it's just something, it's almost like Brady and the Patriots. Like, things just end, and there can be a great power in a goodbye. And I think we underrate that because we're always like first impression and hello, pleased to meet you. Let's see where this goes. But you can do a lot for someone, and you can do a lot for yourself by saying goodbye to them the right way.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, let's move into the realm of Washington Irving and his writings about the Christmas season from the sketchbook of Washington Irving. And these are just, they're wonderful. I wonder, as you look back at that time period, how important is Washington Irving along with Dickens in creating what we think of as Christmas?
Washington Irving usually gets the Halloween. Like, you can have Halloween, and Dickens is Christmas. And Washington Irving goes to England. So he's writing about Christmas in a way as this outsider amongst these customs. He's in the old place. He's not in like the newer version of what England was or has become or anything like that. And he's sad. He's lamenting. And it can give us comfort now, although it doesn't give me comfort to think about how Washington Irving would think about our times. He's lamenting that the world has become too worldly, and idiosyncratic customs, the nooks and crannies of what goes on in specific towns and villages and parishes and things of that nature is being lost. It's still there, if you know where to look for it, he says. But it's losing that quirkiness. So it's becoming homogenized, in other words. Can you imagine what he would think right now? Like, seeing, like, the popping on the Hallmark Channel and the Starbucks coffee cups, like, kind of soulless and everything. Like, no idiosyncrasies. You have to really work to find them now. So I think he'd struggle with that. But he talks, as Dickens does, too, about this idea of life for others and charity, and how the days are shorter, but you go inside and there is the burning hearth fire, and how that sort of contains summer within the house, and it lights up the faces. And when the faces are lit up, they're lit up in a way that they wouldn't be in July or at any other time of the year. And he takes great store and stock and faith and hope in that.
And talking about the relationship with nature and how that changes with the seasons.
He does. He says, normally, get this kind of joy. It's a very Thoreau type of idea. We have to go to nature. And John Clare would agree with that, too. And as you know, John Clare wrote so memorably about Christmas. Like, these are guys that I would really, like, hey, Thoreau. Hey, what's up, Clare? Hey, what's up, Washington Irving? What up, Charles Dickens? And I'd like to get together with them and, like, maybe go out to, like, Bova's here in the North End for a slice of pizza in the North End. I think we'd have a really good chat about Christmas, because they see in it the things that I see in it. And I think the things that I see in it, I've always loved Christmas so much, are not really what at least other people talk about as what they see in it. So I've always retained that childlike fascination with Christmas. And I think I told you one time about, I would go to this bar and the bartender, I was distraught about something. Someone had been rude to somebody outside. It was Christmas season. And he said really flippantly to me, so what do you expect people to be nice to each other because it's Christmas? And I remember saying to him, like, yeah, I actually kind of do. I mean, not just because it's Christmas, but I'd like to see that right now. I mean, do it at least once a year. And Washington Irving is definitely, he's writing about that too in this mini essay that kicks off a series of, because he didn't stop with this. He's like, oh, I should do more of it. And he walks us deeper and deeper into his Christmas experience. Mm. And it ends up becoming like some of the lengthiest altogether writings within the sketchbook. And for people who don't know, the sketchbook has Rip Van Winkle and it has The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. So it's really still like his most famous book.
Did these writings, along with those of Dickens, did they create a nostalgia for what Irving certainly felt was being lost in terms of our Christmas celebration?
He's writing about something so early, and it's interesting because Dickens gets a lot of credit for, like, oh, you created Christmas. with the man who invented Christmas and all of that. And Dickens would have rode with that. He was a shrewd businessman, and he was someone who wanted money. Now, he didn't do his work for the purpose of getting money. I think I've mentioned to you that quote from Thackeray, and Thackeray didn't like anything. He's like famous for not liking anything. He reads A Christmas Carol, and he says, this guy, I feel like I'm this way. I mean, it's certainly what I'm trying to do in my work. This guy has done something nice for you, reader, world. He's trying to help you out. And that was by far the nicest thing Thackeray, at least so far as we know, said in his life about anything he read. And Washington Irving's that way. Thoreau's that way. And these days, because they're white males, you get the whole feminism thing. Oh, it's mansplaining and all this. Like, Thoreau's bad now? No. Thoreau's one of the three smartest people to ever live, and he has a kindness to match that. He also has something called purpose and standards. And it's okay to have standards for yourself and for other people. It doesn't make you a bad person. It makes you an optimist of hope for the human condition that you expect and want and ask more of it. And Washington Irving was that way, too. So, yeah, it certainly helped. But, like, when you read this now, you go back and it just rekindles everything you ever felt at Christmas when you were 6 or 7, and hopefully they were good Christmases, and how you want, like, your family to experience Christmas, and also kind of how you want to be and how you want people to be. And so I couldn't recommend this more to people out there looking for something maybe a little different to read.
Yeah, I ended up reading several of the stories, and it was wonderful. All right, let's shift gears and talk hockey. You had me thinking on this one. The best wrist shots in the history of the National Hockey League.
Yeah, I like that. And people don't know. Maybe it helps to define a wrist shot. I don't know what people know. Do you know what I mean? You can't get in people's heads. You can't. That's one thing I've learned writing for 25 years. You can never assume that someone knows anything, because you'll always be surprised. I'm not saying, like, that everyone should know what a wrist shot is, but, like, people don't know often what the word seemingly means. But a wrist shot is essentially when the puck never leaves your stick. So it's not a snapshot. A
right.
Snapshot is percussive, where you're slapping at, although it's not a slap shot. Doesn't have that wind-up. Like, Mike Bossy had a great snapshot and a great wrist shot. The wrist shot back in the olden days used to be called the sweep shot. So the puck is at the base of the blade of your stick, and you sweep it forward. It moves closer to the toe, and you flick your wrist, and that's where you get the torque. And it's the most accurate shot in all of hockey. Slap shots are famously inaccurate. Snapshots are somewhat better. Backhanders, you kind of don't really know, which makes it difficult, along with the release angle for a goalie. But if you were to pick a spot, I'm going, like, top corner above the glove side, and I'm going to put it right under the bar. The wrist shot would be your shot to go with.
All right, now I started being Bruin-centric, and I have no idea. So I'm the first name that came to mind for me, just from recollection, was Raymond Bork.
That's a great one. If you wanted to have a Bruins player right now, the answer would be Marchand. Most of his goals are off of wrist shots. For Bruins all time, Bork, I would say. And Bork has one of the best ever in the history of the league. And what's interesting about that is that we almost never think of defensemen as wrist shot artists. Because what's a wrist shot going to do when you're out in the blue line? Kind of useless. But Bork was so revolutionary, I don't think he gets enough credit for this, in his thinking, that he was able to get pucks through. He always knew. The thing I would say if I was a coach to a defenseman, I would say, you're not going to score from out there. But that's irrelevant, because you can help us score. Get it through. It's going to create a rebound, a deflection. That's really the aim of the shot from the point. If it does go in on its own without any help or a bounce, all the better. Fine. Awesome. But Bork understood this, and he would get that wrist shot through so often. You have to realize, too, I'm not sure if people are aware of this, he would lead the league in shots on goal quite a bit. This is during the era of Gretzky. And Gretzky, when he was still like, hey, I'm Gretzky, I'm like super goal scorer guy, too. I'm not just like 140 assists a year guy. Bork was leading the league in shots on net. And a lot of those shots of course, were wrist shots. I would say probably the majority of those shots were wrist shots. And people will remember him from the All-Star Game, the skills competition, when he was out there picking corners and going 4 for 4 and busting up those pie targets. And I think he was the first to go 4 for 4. Those were obviously wrist shots. So from a Bruins perspective, I think those are two guys that you would cite, one now, one from the past, is like among the best they've had, probably the best.
Well, another one from my youth that I came up with was Daryl Sittler.
Oh, that's a really good one. Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about him. He did have an excellent wrist shot. It helped to have like a wrist shot that was awesome in like the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's when you could score with the wrist shot. You didn't have, you could beat goalies clean. And you can't really beat goalies clean now that often from that sort of like top of the circle's distance where Sittler would score from. I mean, like Phil Esposito would score in tight, but he was just whacking in rebounds.
Right.
Tipping it. Like Dino Cicerelli was another guy who scored that way, but not like a lot of wrist shots. I think the best wrist shot I've ever seen, well, two different ways to think of it. Mark Messier coming down the off wing. Mm. So he would take the wrist shot, and you wouldn't expect the angle that he had. He scored a lot of goals like that, but only on the off wing. But the best wrist shot overall I've ever seen in terms of velocity, accuracy, and this is key with the wrist shot, is how quickly you get it off. Because that's what's going to help you score more often, I think, than anything else, is how quick your release is. Because if a goalie gets set, he's going to stop it. That's the entire thing. He's not in position yet, especially now. Joe Sakic of the Nordiques and then the Avalanche is, I think, the best wrist shot artist in the history. Like, I don't think you get like a lot of pushback on that. But like Gordie Howe had a great wrist shot. And like you mentioned, Sittler and just guys who wouldn't necessarily.
I had Fedorov on my list, and among current players, I don't know, would you put Ovechkin on that list?
Well, Fedorov is a good one. Another Russian would be Vladimir Krutov, who played like in the 80s.
Mm.
Ovechkin, yeah, I probably would put Ovechkin on that list. And Ovechkin is interesting because, well, he might be the best shooter ever. Because think about Ovechkin, wrist shot, obviously the slap shot, the one-timer. Like, he doesn't take a lot of slap shots like, hey, I have the puck, I'm rushing the puck, I'll take a slap shot. The slap shot for him, like 80% of the time, I'd say at least, is always that one-timer. But he does score, especially for a guy right now, he does score a lot of wrist shot goals. And he's playing so well. I was writing about this in the blog this season. You can always tell with Ovechkin how well he's playing by how many assists he has and what his plus minus is. And people are like, oh, plus minus isn't a great stat. But when Ovechkin is doing more than just being a one-dimensional goal scorer, his plus minus is always like plus 16, I saw something like that. And he's one of the assist leaders in the league. He's playing so well that I'm not really quite sure where this is coming from, because he hasn't played like this in years and he's 36. But yeah, great, great wrist shot guy. One of the best in the league right now.
Interesting topic. I enjoyed kind of going through the memory banks to see what I could come up with.
You are a wizard of of recollecting. Daryl Sittler, that was a good one, because Sittler wasn't like a 50-goal type of guy. He was an assist-first guy. I was pretty split with Sittler, but you don't think of him as like a huge goal scorer. Like, I think I mentioned Bobby Clarke. Like, he wasn't a huge goal scorer. He was like a 30-goal and 70-assist guy. But he had a good wrist shot, too.
Colin so Fleming. Colin, what's the latest on the Scrooge book? You can pre-order it now, right?
You can, yeah, I think it's out. It's like I should know. I think it's out tomorrow. So you should be able to get it at least, I don't know, Kindle or something like that tomorrow if you want it. Tomorrow.
Excellent. And is that the American release or the British release?
It's that Amazon, Kimball. I would think that, I don't know. I haven't checked. Like, I just work. But I would think if you have Amazon, you can get it through amazon.co.uk too. And I'm sure you can get, like, the download of the Kindle or whatever the term is from that, like, in a matter of hours on your device. And everything's weird, too, with printing schedules and all that. Right. So I'm just hoping it's okay. But it's hard for me sort of to shill for something I've done, but it's awesome. I'll just say it, Kimball. It's the best film book ever written, and it's so much more than a film book. People will like it, and hopefully you, my friend of the season, will like it because that matters to me. So, yes, tomorrow, hooray, a book.
I love the film. I love your writing. It's a match made in Reader's Heaven for me. I'm looking forward to it and looking forward to talking with you again next week.
All right, sounds good, sir.
Colin Fleming with us every Tuesday on Downtown.